Chapter 3. 331. Many were sent to Varadesh, not in captivity but as pilgrims ready to learn. They were set to labour for the covenant, as willing servants, not as slaves, building roads and stations, digging canals and founding convents and monasteries upon the route to guide the faithful back to the holy city. From among these converts, thousands were sent forth upon long journeys across the desert, or by ship around the vast coast of the continent. They were tasked by Cor Pharaon to move ahead of the host of Lorgar, to those cities where opposition was yet strong. By word and deed they weakened the resolve of the defenders, sometimes even conducting a coup or otherwise overthrowing the city before the faithful had actually arrived. Among the upper hierarchy of Varadesh, these clandestine missionaries and warriors were known as the Ushmatar Call, the blade that cuts mortal existence to part the way to the Empyrean Mount. They more frequently called themselves the Brotherhood of the Knife. As the word spread across the continent, along the coasts and up the scant rivers, so the network, prosperity and civilization of the City of Grey Flowers grew, sending tribute and people in ever-growing numbers to the coffers and cloisters of the Archdeacon. Cor Pharaon oversaw this vast swelling of temporal power, hordes of converts sent to him by Lorgar inculcated into the beliefs of the Covenant, as appropriately directed by the Archdeacon and his coterie of hierarchs. Never did he stray from the word of Lorgar. Yet as well as the Ecclesiarch's teachings, he impressed upon the newly faithful the need for obedience and discipline, the virtues of sacrifice, and the necessity of determination. Thus moulded, armed, and trained, these faithful were dispatched back across the deserts to return their strength to the host of Lorgar, so that for every servant to the one who fell, conquering the recalcitrant, 10 more eventually took their place. After nearly a whole turn about the sun of Colchis, near 4 years, as the Terran adepts measure such things, the host of Lorgar was numbered in the hundreds of thousands. Mere rumour of their approach was enough to bring the surrender of all but the most zealously irreligious. Cities purged of the irredeemable were founded anew in the image of Varadesh, where academies and seminaries, staffed by Cor Pharaon's chosen, continued to promulgate the message of the Covenant further and further. Missionaries moved even further afield into the deserts, bringing the word of the Wyrmslayer to the tribes of the inner wastes, so that there was not a civilized person nor nomad upon the great continent who had not heard the name of Lorgar. The matriarchs of Tezenesh even dubbed Lorgar the Urizen, meaning the wisest of the wise, the architect of faith, a prophetic and loaded title that had only previously been held, legend claimed, by the prophet Tezen himself. 332. On more than one occasion, the Ecclesiarch voiced his confessions and doubts to Nairo, who became his confidant in the absence of Cor Pharaon, and witnessed the debilitation and exaltation of Lorgar's visions. With each city that fell, it seemed that the Ecclesiarch became both more determined and sickened by what he had unleashed. More fervent became his pleas to those who resisted, though the army at his back bayed for the blood of unbelievers and blasphemers. Several times splinter armies, led by overzealous gun deacons or just wayward followers, beset by the need to prove their faith, attacked wantonly, besieging and sacking towns and cities without the prior knowledge or authority of Lorgar. Nairo suspected the hand of Cor Pharaon in some of these preemptive assaults, for the Archdeacon had always had a thirst for physical chastisement. If the effect had been intended to cow all resistance with these shows of force, the consequence was the opposite. Resistance to the rule of the Covenant hardened against Lorgar. Where at first some may have believed the Covenant not able to reach across the continent to them, the continued expansions and conversion of city after city threatened all. Nairo told Lorgar to sanction these offenders, but the Ecclesiarch could not chastise them for unruly faith, only make it known that he was displeased with any life taken without effort to convert beforehand. Coalitions between the remaining cities formed against the bearer of the word, yet none could match either the oratory or the military power of Lorgar. The Ecclesiarch himself was worth an army of mortal soldiers, at the forefront of every attack, bellowing his prayers to the One, even as he smote those who would defy him. Not on Colchis was born the warrior who could match him face to face, nor the demagogue who could quell the power of Lorgar's voice. Such had become his skill with languages and linguistics. The Ecclesiarch needed only to spend a day in the presence of a native, or to read a handful of the texts of the faithless, to understand their idioms and beliefs, their culture and morals. There was not a dialect or theological argument he could not overcome. And by such means, even as his armies tore down walls and keeps, his words broke open entire denominations and belief systems. Sermonized in their own tongue, many were the potential foes persuaded to convert by this fact alone. Even those who had been raised in abject hatred of all that came from Varadesh were reduced to tears and prayers when subjected to the love and testimony of the bearer of the word. Salvation at the hands of the One, acknowledgement of the benighted centuries that had beset Colchis, freed many from the shackles of disbelief that had held their opinion against the holy city. Nairo saw Lorgar grieve for every life ended. Sometimes 10,000 or 20,000 of the faithful were sacrificed against the defences of the unholy, yet he remembered them in his speeches, and his dreams were haunted by their deaths. "The price of the truth," he would tell Nairo with anguish, "is too high." Then he would order the next attack, knowing that he was set upon a course, and to abandon his plan now would render everything undone, a failure to the One and the millions who now looked to him for spiritual guidance and leadership. 333. Nairo became increasingly worried by Lorgar. The closer the Ecclesiarch came to achieving his goals, the worse it seemed the visions assailed him. He tried his best to shelter Lorgar during these times, when madness and mania threatened, and the Ecclesiarch was reduced to a mewling, frothing wreck in his grand pavilion. There were rumours, fiercely quenched by Nairo and others, that some other malaise afflicted the bearer of the word, some infection of the deep desert he had contracted, or that the spirit of the King Wyrm had possessed him in vengeance for its destruction. His holy master was plagued by them, often through the dark hours of Coldfall, long night and dawn away, sometimes even longer. Nairo begged Lorgar to return to Varadesh to seek the aid of the mentalists and physicians of the holy city, but Lorgar would repeat his vow not to set foot in the City of Grey Flowers while the soul of Colchis remained threatened. Nairo even conspired with Axarta to send secret missives to Cor Pharaon, imploring the archdeacon to come forth and see to the welfare of his adopted son. No reply came, and Nairo was forced to conclude that Cor Pharaon no longer cared for the well-being of Lorgar. He did his best to provide such support and succour as he was able, but sometimes terror at what beset his lord unmanned him, sending Nairo scurrying for the shelter of his own companions, while unearthly rages and depressions enveloped the Ecclesiarch. Despite this, or perhaps because of the obvious touch of the One's power upon their leader, the faith of those close to the Ecclesiarch never wavered during these episodes, and neither did Lorgar's. He emerged from each mania and stupor, invigorated and enlightened, and made fresh proclamations about his beliefs and understanding of the ordering of the Empyrean. 334. Watching the thousands of dead piled onto the pyres outside the broken wall of Carthage, the sky a pall of black from the corpse fires already burning, Nairo tasted bile in his throat. Every city that had resisted had suffered a similar fate. The cohorts of Axarta had stormed the walls and butchered any who gave resistance. Those who laid down their arms, with the young and infirm, were brought before Lorgar to hear the Golden One speak. Few who survived to hear him continued in their faithless ways, but there were always some, buried deep in the blasphemies of their cults, who remained deaf to the truth. with scarves and masks to shield themselves from the smoke and stench. Long columns of the faithful laboured to pile the bodies on the scrub and sands. Ordained priests walked among them, the fume of their censers lost amongst the charnel smog. They prayed for the souls of the dead to be shown mercy by the One, for they did not understand the trespasses they had performed against the truth. Even in the Empyrean, Lorgar hoped to save their souls from the damnation of faithlessness. Doused in blessed oil, the timbers of the fresh pyres were lit, and greenish-blue flames consumed the last sons and daughters of the God's Path faith that had held sway over the Carthaginians. Their remains and spirits carried to the sky among the stench of burned flesh and perfume of thick incense. Nairo felt movement beside him, and a slender dusk-eve shadow fell across the grey sand next to his own.
"More infidels for the One," said Castora.
Always one of the most zealous, even enslaved by Corpheron, the former herald now sported the robes and faux crown of a hierarch. She had prospered under the tutelage and patronage of Lorgar, one of the handful of the original slaves of the caravan who still survived. Lysai had been spitted by a plasma lance at Kuldanesh. Perentha and Koa had both succumbed to Sandlung, wasted away as they undertook the long march between Asakor and Joburgesh. Kaldeka was head of the tutelary that had set up in Naresh Ab, known after its capitulation as the Repentant City. Laura had become a gun deacon, charged with patrolling the highways between Gorgora and Varadesh. Other names and faces crowded Nairo's memories. Hugh Ossis, the leader of the Taranthians, she had died poorly, trampled during a sternback stampede. Declined tribespeople who had joined during the early months after the arrival of Lorgar, and converts who had flocked to the call of the Wyrmslayer. Most of them, hundreds with names he could not recall, now dead. Of the guards, even fewer remained. Axarta, Gundeacon Prime, under Corpheron, a few others in positions of command, the former converts rewarded with battalions and cohorts to lead. Lorgar seemed not to care about this nepotism, his mind occupied by the symphonies of the Empyrean above, the otherworldly choir that only he could hear.
"Men and women," Nairo corrected Castora. "People."
"Ignorant savages," said Castora.
"We were ignorant once. The One does not desire sacrifice for its own sake, but in the labour of the One's works."
"The offering will be well sent, whatever the One desires."
Her exultation diminished as some fresh thought occurred to her.
"What worries you?"
"There is but one city left to bow to the will of Lorgar."
"And that concerns you? That this bloodletting will be over?"
Nairo shook his head.
"I would end this purgation tomorrow."
"Many more will die before Colchis is united," warned Castora. "Gahavala remains, the city of the Magisters."
"The Scourstorm," whispered Nairo. "Hurricane winds of dust and lightning that rage for days, conjured by the rulers of the city. No foe has ever survived to reach the walls of Gahavala."
Castora gave him a long look, no words needed to convey her bleak thoughts. Perhaps with good reason Lorgar had avoided confrontation with the Magisters before now. Yet the fate of the world would turn at Gahavala, as unavoidable and deadly as the coming of the long noon and the freezing high night.